My name is Michelle Uwu and I'm carrying out this interview on behalf of the Wellcome Trust. The aim of the research is to compile a picture of contemporary Britain. Can I ask you please your name, your age and where you come from?
Sharon Hepburn, I'm 52 and I'm where I come from. I was born in Orpington, Kent, 1956. But this is an image of Britain, and I actually don't live in Britain anymore. I live in Canada. But I went to university here. I travel back and forth a lot. So in terms of an image of the nation extends beyond the borders in imagination, in citizenship, in where we feel at home in life. So that's where I'm from. Okay.
And are you a regular visitor to Britain?
I do, almost every year, sometimes twice a year. I was here last October, and last October I heard about this project and knew I would want to be part of it and I would come back again.
What were you doing here last year?
I was just visiting my family, my cousins, in October, just for a week. Just came back and saw the family. Went up to York for a few days just to look around, but it was a family visit, mostly.
So did you remember where you actually saw the project first? So you mentioned the project.
I don't know. No, I don't. But I remember going back to Canada and telling people, oh, it's going to be this great project. And they looked at me blankly, like, you're going to go back and stand on a rock, right? Okay. And then I got a place. And I said, remember that thing I talked about? Well, I'm going to do it. Oh, yeah, okay, right. It took a while for people to realize, oh, you're going to physically be there and stand. What is it called? Plinth? Is it plinth? Plinth? What's a plinth? So, anyway, yeah. But I don't remember exactly where I first heard of it, no.
What was it that actually inspired you to take part then?
I didn't know who Gormley was. I had no idea. And since then, I've looked at his work and love it. The beautiful simplicity and emotion and thought behind it. You know, simple things can be quite resonant if you look at them a particular way, which is what he encourages people to do. But what encouraged me to take part was Trafalgar Square. If it was Hyde Park, I probably wouldn't be there. Westminster, I probably wouldn't be there. When we grew up in, I've written this on my profile on the website, that I grew up in Southeast London, and we had no money. My dad had MS, multiple sclerosis, he couldn't work. My mom worked in a factory. Three of us, mentally handicapped sister. So, you know, even though London was just 15 minutes away on the train, we never came. I just knew that small suburb. My mother's Canadian. And so she hadn't seen much of the country either, or seen London. So when I was about 9, I had very bad eczema and had to go to the St. John's Skin Disease Hospital once every few months. So we had to go to London. So my mother took advantage of the opportunity for both of us. And so we'd come up here, we'd go to Trafalgar Square, because the train came to Charing Cross, we'd go to Trafalgar Square, we'd feed the pigeons, we'd go to the National Gallery, because it was free, and then we'd go to the old Lyons tea shop across from Charing Cross Station, have tea and a bun before we went home, and we'd walk along the river or something. It's very, very resonant memories of my childhood. My mother died 4 years, 3 years ago from cancer, my dad died a long time ago. And so, in a sense, I have with me a photograph of my parents, and I'm coming back to cry, to stand with my parents in a place they brought me to 40 years ago, is what I'm doing. And I thought, so it's because this place has such resonance, and so I'm basically there. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to stand in gratitude. For existence, for birth, for nurturance, for my parents. Gratitude that I've been so fortunate, gratitude that I'm alive. Like, my dad couldn't walk, you know, and he couldn't see, he was blind. So gratitude that I can even walk up there and look out is an amazing thing, and that I have the privilege to be able to come from Canada and do this is why I'm here. And that's what inspires me to do it, and that's why I'm here.
What was it like growing up with those responsibilities, those unusual responsibilities?
It was difficult.
How did it impact?
Oh, it impacted me in a wonderful way. I mean, the family situation was very hard. My parents suffered amazingly. Just the things I've learned since my mother's death about her life before her marriage, my father's life. So I grew up sort of in the midst of fairly deep suffering emotionally and physically and economically. And I'm incredibly fortunate, some quirk of karma or genetics that and life that I've just, my life has been very fortunate. Things have been, I've had wonderful opportunities, and but I think all those difficulties, which I've, you know, obviously had to think about as my life went on, it just fills what I do now. I teach at the university, I teach courses about death, I teach courses about to get people to think about other people's situations, life, and how we can bring our own experiences to our appreciation of other human beings. It's what I teach in many ways.
Can you tell me more about that? How do you approach the subject of death as a teacher?
Oh, it's actually the course is called Culture and Mortality, like, and how the idea, what does it mean to be mortal? And how does that affect how we think about what we are, or how we don't think about what we are? So we talk about different cultures, ideas of afterlives, and what is a soul. But I also want students to pay a lot of attention to just the everyday references to die. Like just outside the plinth, last night I was there, and someone said, "Oh God, I'd die if I went up there." And I thought, how interesting, like, you know, that we can speak of death in such a casual way when there's death imminent. But then when somebody actually dies, we talk about them passing on, going to the Lord or going to a better place. We have all these euphemisms, kick the bucket, falling off the perch. You know, so I really want the students to pay attention to those everyday ways that we talk about death or don't talk about death, how death is presented in medias, like how we shape our ideas of mortality. So they actually, through the course, there's some lectures and readings, but about half of every class that I have them keep notebooks on just, okay, you heard, like, for example, that hearing someone say, oh God, I'd die if I went up there on the plinth. I said, okay, write it down, the context, who was saying it. And then we talk about it, like, why would someone say that? The imagery of death is everywhere. If you go through, I have them go through a newspaper, and at least half the articles have got some word that has the imagery of death, some word relating to death. So it permeates our thinking, but we don't think about it, maybe. So that's what I do. And my father died when I was 10, so that makes an early exposure to something like that. Yeah.
What do you think it would be like? How different do you think it might be to work with British students as opposed to Canadian students approaching the subject of death?
You know, I really don't know. And it's so particular to the university I'm in is in a small city in Canada, predominantly white. Our student base is many people from rural Ontario, white, you know, some in 10% international students, but not tremendously diverse. So even the fact that someone might think about something differently in Toronto is news to them. That's an exaggeration. But in England, you know, every time I've come back, you know, it's so, like, the Asian presence here is so strong. And friends I know teach here, that they're teaching to a very different student base. I can Canada talk about Hindu death rites in India, and they read a few articles about how that's transformed within the British context, right? With Hindus here, they can't do cremations and such, so they go to, open fires. So, it's quite reasonable to press the cremation button. But, if I came here and I'm talking to people who do that, and their parents were from India, and very different sort of engagement, which would be very exciting for me to do that. I'd like that. But I'm very happy with my students as well.
How old are the students you teach now?
18 to 22, mostly. Undergraduates.
What's the degree that they're studying for?
Anthropology. Cultural anthropology.
Going back to what you said earlier about opportunities, you've been fortunate enough to have lots of opportunities. Can you just give me some idea as to the kind of journey that you've taken from that background here to where you are?
Opportunities combined with work. I don't undermine my own effort here. We moved to Canada after my father died. And, you know, things were difficult. Things weren't as easy as my mother thought they might be. So despite her very hard efforts, we ended up living on social welfare a lot, social housing projects. So I certainly wasn't any, and I didn't read, I wasn't scholastic, so it wasn't anything anyone thought. I mean, it was thought I would, I don't know, I left school when I was 16, so it's just odd. That, you know, I've taken the path I have, right? So anyone listening, you know, things don't end just because you make a decision when you're 16. So I was very fortunate. I had met very good friends who, I actually started art school in Calgary when I was 18, Alberta College of Art. And, you know, I moved away from my mother at that time. I was 18, got my first job, at a government liquor store. So I could just about hang it together, support myself, go to art school. And, you know, at that time, a friend, her parents died and she inherited the house. And she said, well, why don't you come live here? So, you know, I wasn't paying rent. I was able to save some money. I had some security in a home. And, you know, I started saving my money. I wanted to come back to England and travel and see England. I hadn't, you know, it's my home. I love coming back here. And it had been 6 years. So I saved my money, and then my friend said, well, do you mind if I come? I said, no. She said, why don't we see Europe while we're there? I said, well, I don't have the money. She says, I'll pay. So she wrote me a check for $3,000, which was a huge amount of money then. And we had another friend, Anna, and she said, well, let's invite Anna. And she wrote a check for my friend. So an incredibly generous-hearted person. Like, she wanted to go to Europe. She wanted company. She knew we didn't have the resources, and without any, you know, airs about her, just, okay, let's make this happen. So that sort of generosity, it opened my heart, opened my life. I saw different things. I started to travel. Had a very influential year in art school, and in fact, the things I learned in my first year of art school became the basis of my PhD in anthropology 20 years later. The ideas about vision, perception, how we know the world. I had some wonderful, wonderful teachers. I've been blessed with wonderful mentors, people who've helped me. I went through a degree I traveled a bit, and I realized, oh, people actually see the world differently. So I went back, and I was going to study nursing so I could travel the world, and then I discovered anthropology, and that was that. Found out people did this, and they asked the questions I was asking. How do we know what we know? How do we believe and know things to be true? And so I just knew this is what I wanted to do, and worked incredibly hard, supported myself. But the opportunities, you know, I decided I wanted to come study at Cambridge here, foreign student legally by that point. And I applied anyway, and they sent me the bill, which was like, you know, £1 million or whatever it was, you know, totally out of my range, right? And I thought, okay, I've just given lots of opportunities again to go to master's programs in Canada. Come February, I got a letter from Jesus College in Cambridge, which said, you know, since writing to you last, you know, we've had a communication. I'm writing to you with the excellent news that all your expenses will be paid for 2 years by an anonymous benefactor. And I've never found out who it is, so whether it's someone who knew me, they were extremely confidential. They wouldn't talk to me in person about it, so they wouldn't even give away the gender. And they said the person doesn't want you to know because they don't want you to feel obligated in any way, morally, ethically, intellectually, personally.
What would you say to that person if you were...
What an angel. And it carries with me a sense of responsibility that things aren't just given to you, that you can make tremendous influence in people's lives. But I've been blessed. I've been fortunate. What an amazing thing, right?
What's the main thing you would say about yourself? How would you paint a picture of yourself?
Well, I think the three words on the website sort of summed it up. Uncertain. Uncertain. And right up until now, I've not known what I was... I mean, I've gone through all kinds of ideas of what even to do on the plinth, right? So sort of uncertain. Like, things can unfold, things can change. My knowledge of the world is limited. I don't know what you're thinking. I don't know what I'm thinking half the time. So uncertain. You know, don't be sure you know things. Be sure... I mean, do the best you can. But there's always things you don't know, and don't assume that you know what someone wants or needs or thinks. Always ask, right? And that the future is uncertain. I could be hit by a truck out here, you know. My life could change, and to sort of keep aware that things can unfold in different ways. So uncertain, accepting, sort of goes hand in hand, that things can unfold different ways. World doesn't have to be what you think it is, but also accepting of all the wonderful, joyous things, you know, without becoming deluded about it, like, oh yeah, I'm great, look how lucky I am. Yeah, yeah. And the last word, actually, the first time I wrote it was fortunate. And then I changed it a few days ago and wrote silly. Silly, I don't know. Fortunate is very true. I thought, wow, that sounds pretty pedantic. Uncertain, accepting, fortunate. And I just wrote silly, because that's sort of how I feel. Like, I enjoy things. Like, I like to have fun. And actually, a lot of the things I thought of doing up there were just kind of silly, you know. And I had a lot of fun thinking about that.
What are your hopes and fears?
I hope that people are disappointed that I'm not doing anything besides just being present. That's the major one. I've got my students watching, you know, some of my students are watching, friends are watching, they're getting up at 4 in the morning, right? So, and they say, oh, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to talk about? You tell such good stories, you know, we're looking forward to it. And I thought, no, this is not a classroom. This is just, I'm here. And so, yeah, I guess I'll disappoint people, but that's okay, that's fine.
Do you have any reservations about
it? Absolutely none. Absolutely happy to be here.
What are your expectations, if any, being up there? What do you expect?
I expect to feel happy. I had dinner with an old friend last night, and she said she would never do it. She'd be terrified up there. Focus of attention, but you know, I just ignore all that. I mean, it's just, well, I'll be interested to see how I feel feeling those cameras on me and people looking at me, and looking to see if they're looking to see if I'm doing anything or not doing anything, and how, just being present. I mean, that's all I want to do up there. And I've got some few friends who I haven't seen for ages, so I'll enjoy waving at them. And I want the mic so I can individually just say thank you to, you know, a few people I know who are walking at home. And just say what I'm doing, what I told you, why I'm here. That's about all, you know.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Just thank you all for doing your lovely work here. Thank you.
Thank you very much.